Hello, welcome back to Pilgrim Pit Stop. It's really great to have you here. Thanks for choosing to give this podcast your time. Time's precious, so I do appreciate you choosing to listen. For those who maybe haven't listened before or have just dipped in and out, this is a podcast about following Jesus through life's highs and lows. And it's just really an opportunity to have some chats. That's it, to be honest. There's no other agenda or vision beyond just having chats with people, having conversations about what it really is like following this incredible, mysterious, and I think life-changing person. So yes, that's kind of the heart behind the podcast, and this is another one of those conversations. I'm just in my local park. I'm going for a little walk. I think, you know, with lockdown, I'm appreciating these walks so much. Just the chance to get out and enjoy nature, and it's a beautiful day today in Derby. The sun is shining, and clear skies ahead, and I think for the rest of the week as well. So that's a real blessing. The conversation you are about to hear, I recorded yesterday, the 26th of May, 2020. And it's a conversation with Brian Zand. Brian Zand. What a great name, first of all. Brian Zand. He describes himself as a full-time pastor, an occasional author, and a would-be mountaineer. And he's the founder and lead pastor of Word of Life Church in St. Joseph, Missouri. He and his wife, Perry, founded the church in 1981, and they've been, you know, they've stuck around ever since, which we were talking in the interview, actually, just how kind of rare that is these days, for a pastor to remain in one church for 40 years, kind of incredible. And he's a pretty sort of rock and roll guy. He loves music. He's a huge Bob Dylan fan. And he has a way of talking about Jesus and talking about God, which is incredibly evocative and stirring, and quite often fairly provocative as well, and challenging. He's the author of a number of best-selling books, including Sinners in the Hands of a Loving God, Water to Wine, A Farewell to Mars, Beauty Will Save the World, and more recently, Postcards from Babylon. And I really appreciate Brian taking the time out of his, I'm sure, very busy schedule to sit down and have a chat with me. You know, we chat about a lot of different things in this podcast. You know, the last few episodes of Pilgrim Pit Stop have really focused on the pandemic, but I'm keen, kind of as we go forward together, to have some conversations that aren't about the pandemic, because there is, you know, there's other stuff going on, and we do touch on the pandemic kind of towards the end of this conversation, but we spend more time really talking about his personal faith journey, what that's meant for him. Sorry, I'm just crossing the road. Yeah, what that's meant for him. And we also spend a bit of time talking about pilgrimage, which is a big part of his life. And as you can tell from the name of this podcast, is something that I'm really interested in as well. So I hope you enjoy.
Things, you know, I you don't know what, yeah. You don't know how it's all done, but yeah.
Yes, it's a crazy time we're living through, isn't it? Well, let's go for it. So it's my great pleasure to be joined now by Brian Zand. Brian, thank you for being here.
Sure. It's my delight to be here.
Brian, I'd love to start with this line that you have, which is, overnight I went from being the high school Zeppelin freak to being the high school Jesus freak.
Yeah.
That's a great line. What caused that transformation, and how did it manifest itself in your life?
Yeah, I grew up in small town Missouri, and I was, you know, nominally a Christian. Our family attended a Baptist church. I wasn't at all thrilled with it, but I wasn't. It was just part of my life. But when I was about 16 years old, I had this very dramatic encounter with Jesus. I don't really know how to describe it. I mean, there was an event, a Christian event involved, but it really was centered upon having a mystical experience with Jesus Christ coming into my room. And I know that sounds all just terribly fantastic, but that's what happened. And it just transformed me. And when I say overnight, I went from the high school Zeppelin freak to the high school Jesus freak. That's a really accurate description of what happened. And I can remember after a few weeks went by, my friends would say, well, first of all, they called me Fry. Nobody called me Brian or Pastor Brian. I was Fry. That was my nickname, but everybody called me Fry. They said, Fry, man, I can't believe what's happened to you. And I would say, I can't either. it's as much a shock to me as it is to you, but it's happened. And by the time I was 17, I was leading a ministry. This is during the Jesus movement, okay, in the mid-70s. And in our city here in St. Joseph, Missouri, city of about 100,000, we had a coffee house, and it was mostly a music venue for the Jesus music scene. And by the time I was 17, I was running that, and it was becoming sort of like a church. I mean, I would book the various musicians, but other times I would teach, and I was leading, you know, kids to the Lord and baptizing them. And by the time I was 22, we just said, okay, it's become a church. And so we started meeting on Sundays, and that was the beginning of Word of Life Church. That's when we started calling it Word of Life. And that was 38 years ago. So, you know, I've been pretty faithful, pretty dedicated to that.
Yeah, that's amazing. And that seems quite rare these days, to be a pastor of a church for 40 years, the same church. I mean, that's unheard of.
Yeah, I think so. But I think it's part of what makes our story interesting. And I don't know, I think it just does reflect a serious, genuine commitment to this particular congregation.
Tell me what it was like being part of the Jesus movement on the inside.
Well, I look back on it with tremendous fondness, probably some nostalgia that colors it a little bit, I suppose. But interestingly, a couple of years ago, I read back-to-back two influential books, one by Alan Kreider. I made it my book of the year, The Patient Ferment of the Early Church. Highly recommend that book. And then the second one is Destroyer of the Gods by Larry, I think his name is like Hurtado, or I think that's it, Hurtado. There are two similar books that are both describing the rise of Christianity in its first couple, two or three centuries. And I was surprised at how often certain descriptions of the early Jesus movement, the original Jesus movement, reminded me of the 1970s Jesus movement, in that it was radically focused on Jesus. There was a penchant for communal living. There was a general disdain for materialism and for militarism. And there was always this sense that the coming of the Lord was nigh. Now, in retrospect, I'll say the Jesus movement probably had two really glaring weaknesses. One, it had a very low view of the church. And the other was its eschatology was pretty much a disaster. But as far as in the early days, as far as being something that was just purely really about the love of Jesus Christ and sharing his gospel with the world around us. It was a remarkable time. It was a genuine spiritual revival. In some ways, I think of it as one of the first, maybe the first, I don't know, revival, spiritual revival that wasn't so much geographically located as that it flowed along lines of just connection. And so, you know, it was present in Western Europe, North America, Australia, New Zealand. And it was capturing young people who were maybe enough influenced by the counterculture movement that we weren't enamored with the traditional values that had been passed on in post-war Western society. But we were also not satisfied. I mean, we had to find a better Messiah than the Beatles, you know. And so, and it's amazing how much came out of that is lasting. In the sense of if you worship in a church where they have guitars and drums on Sunday morning, that's the Jesus movement. I mean, that's where it came from. It came out of that. And then there were just a lot of, you know, as I travel the world, I'm around pastors. It's amazing how many pastors now in their 60s came to the Lord during that time and planted church movements or churches or became church movements. And that's where Vineyard comes from. That's where Calvary Chapel comes from. All of that comes out of that period of time.
Mm. Just an incredible move of the Spirit then.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, I have in my study, I'm here in the basement of my house, but in my study at church, I have a Time magazine cover from that period where it was, you know, it was on the front cover, the Jesus Revolution, they called it. And, you know, it was big enough news that sociologists were trying to figure out what in the world was going on.
Did it feel
it had a certain air of being a little bit dangerous? I liked that.
Yeah. I was going to say, did it feel like a political movement in any way?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by that question. It, in one sense, as far as American partisan politics, it was radically apolitical. We didn't care about that. But it felt subversive. And so that's where maybe traditional churches, older people were a little bit anxious about this. In fact, I remember, I haven't told these stories for a long time. I remember, you know, so we had this thing called the catacombs. So nobody quite knew what it was. Our big meeting was on Saturday night, and it was music driven because you had all of these. You know, the Jesus movement was largely centered around music. And so these artists would come in doing, you know, basically it's rock or folk music of that kind of period. But every song is about Jesus, you know, it's that. And so we're attracting young people. People are coming to the Lord. Sometimes we're baptizing them. But we don't meet on Sundays. Our main meeting is on Saturday. We'd have other meetings for like Bible studies and things like that. But the Ministerial Alliance in St. Joseph got very concerned. And I remember I was maybe about 19 and I was summoned to make an appearance and to justify what I was doing. And they wanted to know, you know, by what authority was I doing these things? Well, I mean, I hadn't been to seminary. I wasn't ordained. I didn't belong to a denomination. So what could I say? I said, I don't know. I mean, I think it's the Holy Spirit, right? I think it's Jesus, which again, sounds very, you know, youthful, cocky. I get all of that. And yet it also smacks of stuff that you will find in the book of Acts. And that periodically pops up throughout history during various moments of revival where the authorization doesn't seem to come from any existing institution. It's just that the Spirit is doing something and you can deny it if you want, but the evidence is all around you that people that maybe the traditional church has not had any success in reaching are suddenly being reached by this other group. Yeah. Now of course our course is the same as all of these kind of movements throughout history. Given enough time, we also then become, you know, an established institution, but that's just the way it works.
Help me sort of soundtrack this in my mind. What kind of music? I know you're a big music man. What sort of music were you listening to at that time?
Well, I mean, I'm still listening to what I liked, you know. I mean, when I went from the high school Zeppelin freak to the high school Jesus freak, I didn't completely jettison Zeppelin. But the Jesus music scene was, you know, you're talking about Love Song, Larry Norman, Paul Clark, The Way, Second Chapter of Acts, Rez Band. Man, I love those guys because they could actually rock. And then more local acts that you wouldn't know of. Some of these people are Phil Kagi, you know, some of these people I'm still friends with to this day. And this isn't, if you know CCM, Contemporary Christian Music, it's not that. Now, it may be the precursor to that, but CCM is very self-conscious about, you know, we are a niche within the music industry that sing Christian songs marketed to a Christian, you know, clientele or customer base. The Jesus movement it was just like, hey, we like rock and roll, and now we've met Jesus. And so this is the music we like, and this is the Lord we love, and it's just going to come out, you know. I mean, you didn't have to tell rock and rollers to write music about sex and drugs. It just came out, you know. And so you didn't have to tell us to write music about Jesus. It just came out. It was very natural. Now, over time, that purity is lost, and because when people found there was money to be made, you know, that's when you get, have a cigar, boy, and sign this contract, and we're going to make you a big star, that sort of thing.
Right, right. Well, I guess that leads on to my next question. So let's fast forward to your mid-40s, and you talk about having kind of a revelation that Christianity, you built your life around, was somehow deficient, I think is the word that you use. Can you just talk to me about what prompted that?
Well, you know, of course, we say fast forward, but man, you know, 25 years are rolling by. So it happens over time. And so my roots are in this radical Jesus movement thing that really funnels into the charismatic renewal, which I describe as good until it wasn't. In its initial days, it was very exciting. There was very much a sense the Holy Spirit was active and something was happening. Over time, it got corrupted with celebrity and prosperity gospel and television and all of that sort of thing. It also, in the American context, fed into the rise of the religious right, which began really with Jerry Falwell around 1980, and then you have Pat Robertson stepping into it. And so, but this all happens over in my, you know, story, in my life, it happens over a course of 25 years. And that's enough time. I mean, a quarter of a century is enough time for things to happen slowly enough that you're not really realizing what's happening. But around the age of 40, I started to be concerned. And then at 45, it's just like suddenly there was an alarm going off in my soul. And I thought, how did I get here? I started off as this radical Jesus freak. And now I'm just, you know, a conservative Republican with a Jesus fish on his SUV. And I just felt like somehow I'd gotten on the wrong bus somewhere and ended up somewhere where I was too compromised with the political agenda of one particular party in America. And my message didn't sound very radical anymore. It seemed like it was mainly just kind of a religious version of the assumed cultural values of America. And so I decided that I needed to get back not only to my roots, but to the roots. And so I began studying church fathers. I went on a long protracted fast. I began reading different material. And in pretty quick order, it transformed me. I mean, I began to change very quickly, theologically, spiritually. And of course, that's going to change how I preach and how I pastor. Now, when I announced to my church in 2004, August of 2004, that I was packing my bags and moving on from the charismatic movement, well, I told it with enough rhetorical flourish and, you know, just skills as a public speaker that the church, you know, stood up and applauded. They were all excited until I actually did it. And then as I began to pull away from religious nationalism, not just pull away from it, but critique religious nationalism, as I began to critique consumerism, as I began to critique the excesses of the Word of Faith and charismatic movements, what was left of it, people weren't near as excited. They'd grown comfortable with those things. And over a few years, we lost about 1,000 people out of our church.
Gosh.
Now, I'm in a town of under 100,000. If you lose 1,000 people, what does that mean? Well, it means for one thing, that if you go to the grocery store, you see them. And these are people that we'd done life with. These weren't just, you know, nameless, faceless, you know, adherents that showed up and filled pews on a Sunday morning. These were people, many of them, that we had just done life with, that maybe I had baptized them. Maybe I'd married them. Maybe I'd baptized their children. And they were leaving and they weren't happy and they were angry and they were thinking somehow I'd backslidden, which was to me the most cruel of ironies, because I wanted to say, man, I think I've front slidden. I think actually what's happened is I've experienced a genuine spiritual revival in my soul, and I was inviting people to join me in this. But it was always hard. It was hard for 10 years. From 2004 to 2014, it was, you know, to quote Dickens, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. It was the best of times for my wife and I, in that we were never more excited about being Christians than at that time. And we were so thrilled to be finding a version of Christianity that was worthy of the Lord we loved. But at the same time, we were experiencing deep personal pain as people we had loved and led and pastored were leaving us. So it was a time of deeply conflicting emotions. But we made it. We made it through it. And I love the place we're at now.
So how does your church look different now to how it did, say, 25 years ago?
Yeah, okay, we'll leave coronavirus out of the
out yeah, of let's, the let's, mix. Let's, assume,
let's,
yeah,
let's pretend it's 2019 for a little bit, okay?
Yeah, please.
So if you come to Word of Life Church, at first you go, okay, wait, I see the drums. I see the electric guitars. Okay, you know, they kind of have a basically rock-based worship deal. Because I belong to those that fought the battles to bring those in. We're not going to get rid of them. But you're also going to know, but they confess the Apostles' Creed. And they're observing the church calendar. They preach from, or at least pay attention to, the lectionary readings. They have the Lord's Prayer. They're using the Book of Common Prayer. They're kind of like rock and roll Anglican or something. So you'll notice that there's a mix of things. It's like Jesus said, every scribe instructed in the kingdom of heaven is like a householder who brings out of his treasure things old and things new. So you're going to find a synthesis at Word of Life Church, some things that are deeply respectful and drawing upon the great tradition, but other things that belong to our more contemporary Jesus movement charismatic roots.
That sounds like a really beautiful fusion of old and new.
Well, I like it. The thing is, I don't have a description for what it is. People say, what kind of church is Word of Life Church? And I'm not trying to be difficult. I'm not trying to be evasive or vague. I just don't know. I don't have a nice handy title for it. I do know, though, that we're not unique. Now, we may be one of the more recognizable or prominent versions of it. But as I travel, or let's say back when I was traveling all the time, that all came to a screeching halt. But when I was traveling, I was, you know, encountering churches like this all over. I think in some ways they're a bit under the radar screen, maybe. But look, it's more and more every day. That is, churches that come from, you know, let's just say a non-denominational kind of charismatic-ish background, or that's been who they've been. At some point, they're becoming interested in things that are old. They're interested in liturgy. They're interested in prayer books. They're interested in sacrament. They're interested in ancient practices of the church and finding ways to incorporate them into our contemporary experience. I'm finding this more and more. I mean, this is who invites me. So I find these churches in, you know, recent months in New Zealand, in Australia, in England, Canada, and of course, many places here in the U.S. Thank you.
Well, talking of ancient practices, let's talk about pilgrimage, because I, as you can tell from the name of this podcast, absolutely love pilgrimage, and actually should have been should have been doing the Camino de Santiago earlier this month, were it not.
Well, I grieve with you that you're not able to do that right now.
Now, I know you've done it a number of times. We were going to be doing the Portuguese way, which I think you've done the Portuguese way and the French way a few times. So can just I don't really have any questions here. Just talk to me about your experiences.
Watch out now, because you know you get me talking about Camino, and you might have to just say, okay, sorry, but we're out of time. Because I love the Camino. Okay, but I don't know where to start, so I'll just start right now. So I just got done doing an hour and a half of online teaching, actually doing some prayer school stuff. And then I had an hour between the end of that and this. And so I had an hour. I was kind of just taking care of some things. And I thought, okay, well, I'm going to go for a walk because I like to go on long walks every day that I possibly can. I had went for a long walk yesterday, even though I knew, well, first there'd been a tornado warning. I didn't go out in the tornado warning. Then that was cleared. Okay, no tornado out there, but it was just pouring buckets. And I thought, I'm still going to go for a 5-mile walk. And I did. And, but my shoes got so drenched that I was sitting out, I was going to change this when I get done with this and go for a walk. And I couldn't wear those shoes because they're still wet. So I looked at I had an old pair that went on the Frances way last fall, and they're completely worn out, almost all worn clear through the sole, but I'll wear them again today one more time. And these are shoes that were essentially brand new when I began in Saint-Jean-Pied-de-Port-au-Prince on, you know, September 14th last fall. And so I can tell you that a pair of trail runners are good for about 1 500 or 800 kilometer Camino, and then
you properly road tested them.
yeah. So anyway, that I just threw that in for fun because I was thinking about it. But most Americans find out about the Camino, at least this latest wave, through the Emilio Estevez Martin Sheen movie, The Way. I don't know if you're familiar.
Right. Yeah. Of course.
Now, having done three Caminos, you know, I mean, Americans kind of tend to, we recognize each other's accents. And so, you know, Americans talk to Americans on the Camino. That, and besides the fact that we only speak English. So I have yet to meet an American that hasn't seen that movie. Most of them, it's how they first learned about it. And then there's a remarkably common story of, oh, you know, I was just, you know, looking around on Netflix and I saw this, man, it's got Martin Sheen. I don't know what this is about. Maybe it's something. I'll watch it. And by the time the credits are rolling at the end, they've had tears in their eyes and they're saying, I'm going to do that. You know, it's the Camino seems to find people when they're ready. I don't want to sound too mystical, but it's as if the Camino calls you. And you just know you have to do this. Well, this is how Perry and I found it way back. And let me figure it out. In 2012, and we said, okay, let's do it in 2016, especially right before the election, because elections are so crazy. We wanted to be away from all that. That was rather prescient of us. And we just thought that was intolerable, the acrimony and the insanity, you know, for simpler times. But now, so we were on 2016, we were an ocean. I said, we got to put an ocean between us and America for you know, 6 weeks. So in 2016, our church had really gone through the, you know, the transition that I talked about, and our church was fine by that time, but we weren't fine. We were still wounded and battered and suffering. And we went and we walked this Camino 40 days, 800 kilometers across Spain. And I don't know how to say it other than just to say it. By the time we arrived in Santiago, our souls were healed. And we will forever love the Camino for the gift that it was to healing our souls. In 2018, we did the Portuguese route starting in Porto. I kind of thought of that as a tune-up, you know. It's like it's 2 weeks, so it's much shorter. But then last year we went back. I turned 60 last year, and that was my excuse, because now I'm just looking for excuses, I turned 60. I guess I'm going to have to go walk the Camino. And so we walked it again, the Frances, the classic 500 mile, 800 kilometer route. In 2016, we both had a lot of foot pain. Really, at times, extraordinary foot pain. You know, I had real bad blisters. Perry had some blisters and plantar fasciitis. And we both just, you know, it was healing our soul, but we walked at least about the first 300 miles in a lot of pain. Towards the end, we felt better. In 2019, last fall, we walked the whole thing. We didn't have a blister. We walked pain-free.
We didn't have a single blister?
No.
That's phenomenal.
They say that happens to 1 in 1,000 people.
Yeah.
And we both walked it without blisters last fall. And we're about halfway through and say, nobody's got any blisters. We're using the same shoes, the same socks. We're doing the same things and no blisters. And again, this is going to sound a little, you know, mystical, but I don't know that I disagree with it. Perry said, you know, in 2016, we were carrying a lot of pain. And that pain had to go somewhere. And it's as if the Camino drew it out through our feet. It hurt our feet, but it drained that pain out of us. And we left it there. And we come back in 2019, do the exact same thing, but we weren't carrying that pain in us. And so we walked it without pain. And again, I know that sounds kind of spooky, spiritual, but Camino's a little bit that way. There is something about the Camino. It's not just like going for a long walk. Here in America, you can, you know, go on the Appalachian Trail, or there's things like that. It's not the same. Something has happened to that place due to over 1,000 years of pilgrims walking it. And you sense it. And of course, people from all over the world walk it. And, you know, but because of its location, you do find a lot of Western Europeans, right? Just because that's in the neighborhood. And so you have a lot of, secular Western Europeans, but I've yet to meet anyone on the Camino, and you meet lots of people. That's part of what you do, who didn't recognize the deep spirituality of it. I remember the first day. If you're, you know, doing, if you're starting in Saint-Jean-Pied-de-Port, France, walking the Frances route, the first day is the most difficult day of all. I mean, your first day is your hardest day because you cross the Pyrenees. So it's a big climb, big ascent. And then you drop down into Roncesvalles, across the border in Spain. It's a long, hard day. It's about 15 miles with elevation gain and all that sort of thing. And there's really about only one place for a lot of people to stay. There are some little, you know, accommodations, but just because of where it is, you're still in the Pyrenees Mountains. There's this large monastery that for centuries has housed pilgrims. And so you check into this thing and you're in this big albergatory, the albergue, kind of a dormitory setting with bunk beds. And they tell you as you check in that there is a pilgrim mass, you know, a blessing for the pilgrims at whatever time, I think it's 8 p.m. And Perry and I had made up our mind we would just go to all that sort of thing. But we thought, there'll be a handful of people. No, it was packed out. And that remained consistent, that in these little villages where there would be a little village church, if they offered a pilgrim mass or a pilgrim blessing, the pilgrims, even though many of them had no background in church, would show up for it. Because you're not on the Camino for a day before you recognize, I'm in something here that is spiritual, and I want to participate in as much of this as I can. And so I find it interesting for that reason.
Yeah. You must have had some incredible, well, encounters with both other people, as you've described, but also with God. On that walk.
Well, let me tell you. Let me tell you an encounter, a story from the Portuguese route that maybe is an encounter with people and God sort of simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
on the Portuguese route, Perry developed a stress fracture in her left leg and was she ended up on crutches for 6 weeks. We didn't know she needed to be on crutches till we got back, but halfway through she had to abandon. She just couldn't go. So she would just take taxis from place to place. And so I was walking the last week by myself. And I was walking one day and it was hot. I've got my kind of my sun hat pulled down over my head, and I come across a fellow pilgrim, a peregrina, and she's an American. And so we start talking and she starts telling me her story, and she's just been through a divorce, and she's a Christian, but she's suffering from doubts. So I was able to just kind of minister to her. I talked to her for a while, you know, and I think I said some things that were helpful. I seen her for a while, you know, but I walked for 2 hours because you're just walking. So you have a lot of time just to really talk. And so we'd gone for a good long while. And I said, well, what's your name? And she says, Melody Miles. I said, oh, I said, what a great name for a pilgrim on the Camino, Melody Miles. And she said, well, what's your name? I said, Brian Zond. And she just stopped and burst into tears. I thought, what in the world? She said, I've been praying to meet you. I've read your books. I thought maybe if I could talk to this guy. And I tried to, you know, find out how to connect. I knew you were walking. I follow you on Instagram. I knew you were walking the Camino, but I couldn't find out how to connect with you. And I don't really, I post stuff, but I don't look at all the comments and I never look at my messages. I just don't. I'm only going to do so much, you know. And she said, I was praying to meet you. And we did. We, you know, we just, it was just, and because, you know, I mean, you know, I didn't look like a preacher. and I had on my shades, and I'm all sweaty, and I got my hat pulled down over my face because it's sunny. She didn't recognize, she'd walked with me for like 2 hours and didn't recognize me. And I don't know. That was, I don't know if I'm doing a good job of communicating how special it felt in the moment that God had heard her prayers and arranged some things to happen.
No, that's really, really beautiful. Really, really beautiful. Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing, Brian. I like kind of living vicariously through your stories, and I really hope that one day I will be able to do this pilgrimage. I'm really, yeah. Really,
oh, you will. And you know what? When you get ready to do it, I don't know if you post on Instagram or something. I'm always looking for people who are beginning a Camino and that are going to post on it, because I'll follow them the whole way and I'll pray for them, you know,
God bless you. We probably should talk a little bit about the, you know, the elephant in the room.
Look, I warned you about bringing up the Camino. I told you.
No, it's good stuff. Let's talk very briefly. I don't want to talk too much about the pandemic, but let's just talk about what are you learning about following Jesus through this incredible time of history that we're walking
through? You know, I find that a difficult question because it's all still happening. You know, I find what am I learning? I don't know. I'm learning in the American context. I'm learning things I don't want to learn. I'll get to the positive stuff, but I want to start with the negative. I'm learning how highly dysfunctional we are. This first really became, I mean, it was kind of on my radar screen in February. Early February, I was in New Zealand, and there was talk about this coronavirus thing, but we weren't really too concerned about it. And then it became a big deal when Perry and I were in Israel, and we just got back. I mean, we were like the last people out. We just got back in time, and you know, by the time we arrived, everything was locked down. You know, everybody's quarantined, churches aren't meeting. But as I was getting the news, our final days in Jerusalem, my great fear in America was that this would be politicized. and that people would take positions based on politics and not on other more reasonable factors. And that's what's happened. And so I see how terribly dysfunctional America is increasingly becoming because of its deep partisan rift. I don't know where it ends. I don't know where this ends up, but it's not a healthy thing. And it's a struggle for pastors to try to keep the church above the fray and out of that sort of toxic participation in partisan politics. I personally have just learned, I'm something of an introvert. That I didn't just learn from, I mean, I know this, right? I can pass myself off not as such because, you know, I'm a public speaker and all of that, but that's a controlled environment. So, for example, at church, to speak, or wherever I go, this isn't just true at Word of Life Church, this is just wherever I go, anywhere speaking. I rarely get nervous to speak. That's kind of what I do, and it's just, I'm very comfortable doing that. I enjoy doing that. It's following the church service, the meeting, the event, when I've got to kind of like mingle with people. That's what I find, I don't know what the word is. It's a little bit draining for me because mm-hmm. I'm never quite sure how to engage with people. And so if I'm just being brutally honest, and I'm not saying this speaks well of me, but it's like when that part is over, it's a little bit of a relief, you know, to meet people and shake hands. And because I just feel a little bit out of my element. I'm not quite sure how to engage with people. And I think, you know, I think I do an adequate job with it. I do know that my wife is like so much better at this, you know, and so after I've been home for a half an hour on Sunday, she's still at church. Shows you what a great pastor she is, and I'm not, I suppose. But anyway, so I said all that to say how much I miss that. I mean, you know, what I wouldn't give just to be in the lobby, talking to people, shaking hands, hugging people, even though sometimes I find that a bit intimidating, which sounds odd, but if people are, the introverts are going, I get you, man, I feel you, I know where you're coming from. I miss it. I miss being around people. I know how much we need each other. Technology is a great thing. You know, we're all Zooming and yeah, Word of Life Church, we're pretty skilled in this area. And so our streamed services are excellent. They're top notch. I don't think anybody's doing it any better on a technical side. You look at it and say, man, they really do a good job there. But it's such a far cry from that which the church is actually supposed to be, because we are incarnational, we are sacramental. To be the church is to be a gathered thing. So if somebody says, oh no, this is the wave of the future for the church, I say, well, God forbid. These are emergency measures. I'm not fighting against it in the sense of, you know, our leadership team at Word of Life Church, we are completely compliant and willing for the sake of public health, because we love our neighbor as ourselves, to do what needs to be done or not do what we want to do in order that we can, you know, help in this pandemic. But the way we are doing church through technology is not for us in any way a substitute for what we can do together once the, you know, emergency is over.
Mm. Are you finding any particular spiritual practices or rhythms of prayer, you know, useful at this time?
Yeah, I mean, prayer is a big part of my life anyway. Prayer and teaching prayer and leading prayer schools. I'd always refrain from doing prayer schools online because I just felt like there was just so much that would be lost. And so I just wouldn't do it. But when this came along, I had so many people say, look, you know, we need this help during this time. And so I said, oh, okay. So I've done two of them. Let me work numbers in my head here real quick. We've had about almost 900 people, 900 accounts. A lot of them are couples, you know, 900 people or accounts, computers registered to participate in these prayer schools. So that tells me something of the hunger that's out there.
Mm.
And so, yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say that my rhythms have been all that much changed. I'm kind of fortunate. I mean, what has changed is I'm not traveling, which I do a lot of, but that's not happening now. Prayer is the essential rhythm of my life. It has priority. But I have been able to help people for whom that hasn't been the priority. And this has been a time for them to maybe lean more into that. And so I'm glad to be able to pastor in that regard. And some people are really finding the need for a daily rhythm of prayer during this time.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting kind of looking at the news articles about global search terms on Google. And it seems for a lot of these articles I'm reading that people are Googling prayer and people are looking into it and people are signing up for prayer courses, Alpha, you know, there's all sorts of interesting things happening in the culture.
And yeah, I saw a report from the UK, I can't remember the numbers now, of people, it was a significant number of people who never attended any kind of Christian service, have been doing so online.
Mm.
Which, yep. Maybe there's a couple of things going on. Maybe on the one, maybe the present crisis has awakened in them spiritual yearning. That could be one thing. The other thing could be it also does afford, because they know these churches are doing this, and it's a way for them to sort of safely, you know, dip their toe in the water without actually showing up and how that might make them feel uncomfortable. So I find we are being presented with interesting opportunities for evangelism. And at Word of Life, I mean, we're kind of known, I mean, a little bit. And so, and we've streamed for, I don't know how long we've streamed. We've been streaming since almost you could do such a thing. So that's not something new for us. But all of a sudden we had this huge uptick in, I mean, not just because, of course, our congregation is now only attending online, but just people around the world or across the country said, well, I've always kind of been curious about this Word of Life. Well, this gives them a chance to actually, you know, come check us out. So it's kind of interesting.
Mm. Just finally, Brian, is God speaking to you through any scripture over these past few weeks?
Yeah, I have been, I've been writing, you know, that's, I kind of wear three hats, pastor of a local church, and then I'm a traveling speaker, and then an author. Right now I'm down to two hats. And so a lot of what I'm thinking about, trying to understand what the Holy Spirit is saying, is going into the writing I'm doing. The title of this book, I don't have a subtitle, the publisher's going to want one, so I'll let them give it one. But my title is, What Can We Do When Everything Is on Fire, which I began in December. Now the title sounds more timely, but I'm really talking about how to maintain faith in an age of increasing secularity. And so I'm really wanting to help people who are struggling with doubt, going through what some people call deconstruction. Part of what's happened is we have been moved away from what we know should be the truth. That is, that the only foundation for Christian faith is the revelation of Jesus Christ. We don't arrive at revelation by some other intermediate steps. That is the beginning place. That's where faith begins. It doesn't begin by an apologetic argument for the Bible. And now we believe the Bible, and so now we believe in Jesus. No, it doesn't work that way. It begins by God being pleased to reveal his Son to us. Who do you say that I am? You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah. Flesh and blood has not revealed this to you. You didn't figure this out. You didn't do a logical inquiry. You didn't read the case for Christ. It simply was revealed to you. And so I'm wanting to help people understand that, in fact, you can trust your heart, that Christ dwells in our hearts by faith, and that this is not some sort of secondary way of knowing. People say, well, yeah, but your heart can deceive you. I say, well, yeah, your mind can be deceived too. But if we form our hearts in proper way, we can, in fact, encounter God through the proper organ design to receive revelation, and that is the heart. So those kinds of scriptures, those kinds of texts, where, in fact, the Christian faith is self-authenticating through revelation. Now, this is a claim that has been consistent with Christian theology from day one. It cannot be proved, but neither can it be disproved. It's just we witness to it that we know Christ not because of a series of proofs, but because he has been revealed to us. That's how I encountered Christ as a teenager. And even though I can maybe speak on it in more sophisticated and developed ways, in one sense, I haven't ever moved beyond that. That I know Jesus Christ because he is revealed to me.
Well, that seems like a pretty good place to wrap things up. thank you so much, Brian, for your time. I really, really appreciate it.
Oh, I enjoyed it, and it's good to meet you, and I for sure hope that you're going to be able to get back on the Camino pretty soon here.
Well, me too.
There we go. That was my conversation with Brian Zond, and such a great time, such a rich discussion, and many thanks to Brian once again for choosing to come and share his heart on this podcast. Fabulous. So that's us done. Just one conversation this time round. You know, I think I do always prefer the longer form conversations. And I know over the last few weeks, I've had the opportunity to hear shorter bursts of chat from different people. But I think, you can't really beat a good full conversation like that. So got a few more of those lined up. Recorded another one with someone a few days ago as well. And I'm really excited to share that with you. I just want to thank Johnny Davies for creating the theme music to this podcast, and to Thomas, my brother, for creating the jingles that you've been hearing sort of dotted throughout. I just want to end on a quote, actually, from a very brilliant and wise man who actually died just over a week ago, Ravi Zacharias, Christian apologist. And what can you say about him that hasn't already been said? Just an incredible man of God. And if you haven't read his stuff or seen him speak, I would really urge you to have a look online. Quite an incredible man. I just want to end with this quote from him that I've been really sort of reflecting on over the last week, really. No matter how much we try to run away from this thirst for the answer to life, for the meaning to life, the intensity only gets stronger and stronger. We cannot escape these spiritual hungers. Bless you, Thank you for listening, and I will catch up with you in 2 weeks' time. God bless.